كانت ميراندا فيها يعني جنا صراحة أكسر المدامينا This my sweet Sri Chaitanya Mano Vishtam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Vedati Sakajantikam Pancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhai Vicha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Yadvaita Gadadhar Yivasadevor Bhaktananda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I'm continuing my study of the Bhagavatam, so I have a few things that I picked out from there. But also, one of the Sangha members, Nila, sometimes known as, I can't even pronounce it, Gail, Anastasia, or something like that. She sent me a book called The Inner Experience, Notes on Contemplation by Thomas Merton, who was quite a famous Trappist monk. I think he's also wrote that appreciation for Prabhupada's early Bhagavad Gita. I forgot about that. Right now also in my personal studies, I'm trying to prayerfully read the Bhakti Sandarbha again, my own personal edification. But the Bhakti Sandarbha is establishing Bhakti as the Abhideya Tattva, or the means of realizing the Absolute Truth, on the basis of the Bhagavatam. So that's actually how I study Prabhupada's books. It's really nice. I'm studying Bhakti Sandarbha, and when a reference is there from the Bhagavatam, I read the Bhagavatam in Prabhupada's purports. Excuse me. And I've really gained a special appreciation for Prabhupada's purports. It's a different type of scholarship than the kind of scholarship that tries, which is the kind of scholarship that I'm inclined to in many ways, is try to put things in context. And as those of you who know the way I speak, I like to do that. My appreciation in Srila Prabhupada is something that's there, but something else is that his depth of expression of Sambandha Gyan. I remember we had a scholarly conference recently, a gathering that I've been holding for many years, mostly among some friends. And the discussion came up about the need for theologians and what is the qualification of a guru. Does a guru have to be a theologian? Does he have to be a big scholar? Of course, in one sense, a teacher should be learning, of course. Because the business of a spiritual teacher is to clear doubts. Establish faith. Faith is Shastriya Shraddha. It's faith in the scriptures. So the person has to have that knowledge to be able to. But in another sense, and this was a nice point actually for Jumda was there, and he made a nice point that according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the qualification of a guru is that he's fixed in Sambandha Gyan. And Sambandha Gyan means the Sambandhagyan means metaphysics, but metaphysics here is knowledge of relationship. What's that relationship? To understand reality, you have to know the relationship between Krishna and Krishna's energy. Basically, there's matter, spirit, and the controller of both, knowing the difference between the soul and the body, knowing the relationship between the soul and the body, knowing the relationship between the soul and God. If you don't understand the relationship with the soul and God, you think the soul is God, you can't have metaphysical understanding. You can't develop your relationship with Krishna. Understanding the relationship between Krishna and matter. If you think that Krishna is a product of the world of goodness, as some forms of Mayavada philosophy, you can't develop a relationship with Krishna. You don't understand reality. So the qualification is that Sambandhagyan may not have vast scholarly knowledge, but he or she has a deep understanding of reality and experiences that and sees it in the world. That's my appreciation, that's what Prabhupada's trying to do. Because he's elucidating the purports, no doubt, helping us understand it contextually. But the stronger focus, I feel, is using any point or reference to express a deep understanding of reality and communicate that understanding effectively. And I know from my own spiritual life, I need that. And I just think it's a very, very special thing. So I'm reading like that. Now, at the beginning of the Bhakti Sandarbha, where these verses beginning with Savai Pumso Paro Dharmo Vito Bhakti, in answer to the sages of Namasharanya's question, what is the ultimate and absolute good? And their answer is it's devotional service. So that's the Abhideya, and that's the means. It's devotional service. That's it. So there's these verses about from 5 to 22, I think there's about 17 verses on Abhideya Tattva, how you realize the Supreme Lord by devotional service based on chanting and hearing. And I believe the Jiva Goswami indicates that that's really the core of the Bhagavatam right there. So I'm reading those verses and got up to a verse, Sushu Shro Shadid Hanasya Vasudeva Kata Vichi Syat Mahasevana Vipa Punya Kirtana Shevana. That Siddhi Goswami has just explained that it's devotional service is the Abhideya. Therefore, one should chant, hear, and remember Krishna always. And then the question comes up, what if one cannot do that? It's simple. That's our process. Our process is to chant, hear, remember Krishna. That's what we should be doing. That's what we should be doing when we're on the line to the bank. I read this book by Ekanath Ishvaram about mantra chanting. Someone had it. I looked interesting. I read it. But one point in life, he said, in terms of mantra chanting, you should always be chanting the mantra. And he gave just practical examples. You're waiting online, Ram, 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 developing relationship. So there, but it's not as easy as it looks. So what to do if you can't do that? Well, it does recommend then you should visit holy places and meet sadhus. Not going to India, then going to where the sadhus now by Prabhupada's grace are living, in the West, but you must go to sadhus. because these sages, who are very pious, they're frequenting these sacred pilgrimages places where the Lord has his pastimes, and where we may not be able to access those pastimes, they can. Just talking about holy place, I'm feeling separation from the novel. When you're out of it, you just really realize how potently spiritual that whole place is. By the, you know, it's just this Krishna conscious place. Maybe not everybody there is Krishna conscious, but there sure is a heck of a lot of people that are. It's powerful and it's potent. People just living their lives for God. And those people, they keep the lotus feet of Krishna within their heart. You go to these holy places, and Krishna is there in the hearts of these devotees, and Sushushoshana Vasudeva Katha, you'll get Vasudeva Katha Ruchi. You'll get a taste for hearing about God. And that's the entrance to bhakti. That kind of faith. The faith to hear about God. And how will you get it? By serving the great devotees. And serving the great devotees is even seeing and appreciating those great devotees. But if you serve the great devotees, then you'll see what their life is like. It will be very inspiring to you. So Prabhupada says, well, actually, this is in the Bhakti Sandarbha, becoming situated in a person's consciousness through the medium of katha, the Lord destroys the material desires in the heart. So through katha, God comes into the heart. Through hearing about Krishna, God comes into the heart. I don't have it in order, but this is with sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? How glorious is God? How glorious is Krishna? That if you remember his message, if you remember the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you'll be free from karma. You'll become liberated. It's a sword. And it cuts through karma. Because what is karma? Karma is the activities that give us this body. Karma is selfish or fruit of activities. And to bear the fruits of those activities, we have to take a material body. That's the bind. That's the rope that keeps us here. So who will not pay attention to this katha? Who will not pay attention to this message, which will cut through the binding knots of that reactionary work? So, again, this is purport from Bhakti Sandarbha. The word kovida, the wise, refers to those with fine discrimination. The word yukta, self-control, refers to those who have subdued their minds. Thinking or meditating on the Lord Hari itself is the sword to cut asunder the knot of karma that binds the ego to various bodies. Who would not feel attraction to such pastimes of such an entity? Who will not be attracted just to an entity? Simply by hearing to them, hearing about them, it cuts the in karma. Because it changes the desire. Why are we in this world? Because we are not surrendered to God. We want to enjoy separately from God. And when you hear about God in the right attitude, then the desire to serve God, which is antithetical to the consciousness that keeps us bind bound in this world. It's not a cruelty of keeping us bound in this world. We are bound in this world by our desire to be independent of God. We're bound in this world by our aversion to the Supreme Lord, and therefore our aversion to our own selves as servants of God. So if you hear those messages and you become attracted to God, then you transcend this body and mind. So that's there. Now I'm going to read a little bit from Thomas Merton. So he actually wrote this book on contemplation when he first came to Christianity. And he wasn't, and then later on, he revised it. This is the revised edition. And he kind of felt that his initial edition was quite immature. And he describes in the introduction what the mistake was. He said, how mistaken I was to make contemplation only part of a man's life, for a contemplative, his whole life is contemplation. It's not just a sadhana or a practice, but for a contemplative, his whole life is, and it really hit me today. You know, recently I've been just traveling. So now for about a week and a half or 2 weeks, I'm just staying put. And I have this wonderful place, and I just sat in this wonderful place, and I just got everything that was pending done practically. Cleaning out file cabinets and answering letters and looking through notes of people's addresses and throwing out things and straightening things and cleaning things. And I cook myself. I wash my own clothes. I clean the place. I'm basically all alone. I have company in the neighborhood now. It's like Sachi and Kaylee are here, another cleanies. They should come back from Vietnam. Sachi Rukmar lives across the street. And Baladev Bhushan is there. So sometimes I was invited over for lunch one day, and I took my afternoon walk at 5 o'clock, and I ran into Satsrup Marj on the way back from his walk, and he invited me in for some cold lemonade. And it's really nice to see. He's up at 1:30 every morning. And I'm also up very early, but he's up at 1:30 every morning and basically goes for 12, 14 hours, just chanting, hearing, writing, reading, like that. So it's nice to see. Nice to have example of a sadhana like that and kind of, in one sense, back to his own self. It's just nice to see him just so fixed like that. So anyway, I have a chance to think about it because, I'm here, so this content, it attracts me. It attracts me, the contemplative life, where the cultivation, of course, I guess this is more renunciate in one sense, but we can gain inspiration and application in our life. But it's inspirational. That his whole life is a contemplation. And he was lamenting when he came to a monastery, which is for that purpose, that he made this dichotomy. But I was thinking to myself, oh, no, I should not have this dichotomy. Everything you do should be searching for that inner self. And then he made a very beautiful statement here. He said, he was talking about the misconceptions he had. He said in the earlier work, this is the person edited, he was too superficial, too cerebral. And he said, and then he wrote, that was when I was a rip-roaring Trappist, I guess. Now that I'm a little less perfect, I seem to have a saner perspective. Doesn't that just seem, it sounds like me. I put my own name, that's when I was a rip-roaring devotee, I guess. Now that I'm a little less perfect, I seem to have a saner perspective. Because that is the illusion. The illusion is that somehow or other we're perfect. The desire never to be wrong or never to accept our frailties, that egotistical conception, the driving force that brings us into the world. And then life purifies us, life humbles us. And then we have a saner perspective. Because a saner perspective, we see our own dependency, our own frailty. So I thought that was kind of a nice thing. I really feel, too, like spending more time on this. I just, you know, it's just like, you know, strike when the iron's hot. There's so much opportunity for me to teach now. I mean, I did a program in New York. We had 40 people coming. I see there's a real opportunity for that. Now, this is also, he's making a comment on it seems almost like a comment on like a self-help. Men in our day, menaced on all sides with room, is at the same time beset with promises of happiness. Threat and promise often come from the same source. So this threat of ruin, this promise of, like, you could promise of that, both hell and heaven have become, so they say, immediate possibilities here on earth. But then he goes on and he says like that, and he's talking about in the midst of this moral and emotional chaos, popular psychologists and religious teachers, men of pathetic optimism and goodwill, have rushed forward, hopefully, to announce their message of comfort. Their message of comfort. This is the line I like. Seldom concerned with the afterlife, whether good or evil, as befits men of our times, they want to set things right for us here and now. Well, there's some sense of that, too, in Krishna consciousness, that, you know, the spiritual world is a matter of our consciousness, and we can be right here. I guess this is a little bit of a Christian thing, but at the same sense, you know, the one shot, hell or heaven, but at the same sense, you know, it realizes that there's something just deeper than comfort. We're not against comfort. We're not against the social, mental, and physical peace, and it should not be neglected. But the higher endeavor is to realize it's all, and that's the goal. And if you take away the goal, then it becomes what profiteth a man get if he gains the whole world and loses eternal soul. Takvasa dharmam charanam bhujam are bhujana pakto tvat kate yado yati. Same thing. One gives up the world to try the highest endeavor, then what is the loss? But, you know, if you don't get God, then what is the use of everything else you do? There's a perspective of the soul. And that's why it's sometimes hard to deal with an extremely spiritual person, because they see clearly that this temporary world, this family, etc., it's superficial to this in terms of the eternal perspective, so they see in that very, very broad spiritual way, and they have it heard the Bhagavad Gita, Sochan Andasochas Twam, Pragyavadams Jabhasita, Katasan Adasita Anasochatipat. While speaking learned words, Arjuna, you're a fool, because the wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. It's not that they're not compassionate. They are suffering when others are suffering, they're suffering, but they see that the problem is people are in ignorance, not that they die because or they're born. Because from that perspective, matra sparsha stukontaya sitoshta sukadukada agamapayano mitta, the non-permanent appearance, happiness and distress, and their disappearance in due course of time are like the changing of the summer and winter. The self-realized self, the person doesn't be bewildered by them. I may get back to that one, but let's see. And it's a very nice section of how you realize the inner self. A very beautiful thing here, too, because he gives some reference to T.T. Suzuki, who is a Buddhist, and he clearly outlines the difference between Buddhistic thought and Christian thought, which also is very, maybe, and you put Islam, Jewish, and you have a theistic conception. The goal is not just to realize the self. It's for the self to realize God. And sometimes you see that in yoga. It's imbibing or dwelling in the self. But there's no conception of the spectrum of the self. Ours is not to become self-realized. Ours is to become God-realized. So it's a little bit different. But he speaks of that, and it's a very interesting concept that, and it's consistent with bhakti. And I like when I see conceptions that I've been struggling to understand or trying to understand deeply. Sometimes you see them in another context, you understand them. So it's the kind of a concept that the sadhula, the bhakti, is very difficult because there's no way to practice. It's rare to achieve bhakti because it's in the hands of God and it's given by God. In other words, there's a conception that our efforts alone cannot achieve, our sadhana alone. It's not, it's that verse, Nityasiddha, that it's eternally existing. It's not something that manifests. It's not something that we create by our sadhana. It's something Baba descends. It descends. It's not something that we earn. And I always was contemplating this point of what is the benefit of our efforts if bhakti is the path of grace. I always told you that I had that kind of realization one day. I was in this summer in Vrindavan. It was so hot that I had to go in and do something for someone back in the West, and I promised it. It had to do with some deities. I was sitting in a shop, and it was so hot. I came there by rickshaw, and the shop, while I asked him, he wanted a drink. I wanted these little mango drinks. And they searched around, and they got me these cold little mango drinks. And when I was about to drink my two mango drinks, this beggar child came and puts his hand to his mouth and begging me. And my first reaction was, oh, my God, get away. This is so inauspicious, you know, that someone lust over your food. So I kind of made a turn my head and, like, kind of indicated, no, get away. And it left. And then I thought my conscience, actually what happened is, because I thought, you know, sometimes they always say in India these kids are rich and they're beggars, whatever, you know, don't spoil them. When he started walking away because the shop was up high, when I saw him from the waist down, I didn't want to describe it, how destitute he looked. And then I wanted to give him a drink and he turned the corner and disappeared. So I felt like the ugly American. But then I had a realization, this is how it works. He didn't earn. If I gave him that drink, it's mercy because he did not earn it. He did not pay for that drink. But he did something that invoked my desire to give him that, and that was manifest his need. When I actually saw it was a legitimate need, then I was inspired to give. So that's really what our practice is. It's not just a mechanical practice, but it's not irrelevant. It's an expression of our need. And when the practice is aligned with a service attitude and a mood of a need for mercy, or if it purifies our heart by chanting the mantras, it purifies our heart, then that can attract God. It's not that I chanted three lakhs, I deserve to see God. It's I realize my absolute dependence and need, and therefore I am begging God for mercy. I have not earned it. I have not qualified. One of the strange laws of contemplative life is that in it, you do not sit down and solve problems. You bear with them until they somehow solve themselves, or until life itself solves them for you. Usually the solution consists in discovery that they are only existed insofar as they were inseparably connected with your own. This is another point. So when you actually see what the problems are, they're not. Most of our problems don't exist because most of the problems are the dream, not the reality. Most of the problems are in relationship to the person in the dream, the false exterior self. So a contemplative, he's not working in the world, of increasing happiness, reducing distress, or he does it minimally so. And he'll see the problems go. I know a lot of times when there's a problem that I have to solve, a person problem, they write me, you know, and I'm passionate, I want to get involved, but somehow or other, I can't do anything at that time, or I forget to answer the email. A lot of times things solve themselves, even in your own life. Most of our problems solve themselves. It's not that we did anything. We just went away. And we connect with the false self. So the solution of most such problems comes with the dissolution of this false self. And consequently, another law of the contemplative life is that you enter it with the set purpose of seeking contemplation. Well, you know, if you enter it with the purpose of seeking contemplation, or worse still, happiness, you will find neither. Because once you put yourself in a self-centered conception, that's what happened to Narada Muni. He was practicing. And God came. He showed him mercy. Then he tried the same practice. But because he had achieved something by the practice, the next time he practiced, his practice was imbued with some type of egotistical conception of doership. So, but let me find these. There's some things he said that I want to read about, that I really liked, about how to achieve perfection. It's not your effort, but it's the work to create a conducive atmosphere. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, don't try to see God, but act in a way that God will want to see you. So it will be ironical indeed if the exterior self seizes upon something within himself, what he says. The inner self is precisely that self which cannot be tricked or manipulated by anyone, even by the devil. He is like a very shy, wild animal that never appears at all whenever an alien presence is at hand, and comes out only when all is perfectly peaceful, in silence, when he's untroubled and alone. So it's such a nice image how you realize the self. It won't come out like a shy animal when there's an alien presence. So as long as there is the exterior self and the conceptions and relationship with the exterior self, the six whips, the greed, the illusion, the fear, the anger, and the chitta vritti, the passion and ignorance, the thoughts, the endless tape of the mind. I am the enjoyer, I am the controller, I am unhappy, I didn't get this, I am unhappy, I don't want this. Then in the inner self, it doesn't appear. It's not. But when that is cleared by spiritual practice, and the shy, wild animal that never appears whenever an alien is present comes out only when perfectly peaceful and silent, when he's untroubled and alone. It's a beautiful conception of how that works. Beautiful, beautiful. It says, the inner self is as secret as God, and like him, it evades every concept that tries to seize hold of it with full possession. It is a life that cannot be held and studied as object, because it is not a thing. Anyway, it is not reached and coaxed forth from hiding by any process under the sun, including meditation. All that we can do with any spiritual discipline is produce within ourselves something of the silence, the humility, the attachment, the purity of heart, and the indifference which are required if the inner self is to make some shy, unpredictable manifestation of his presence. That's all we can do. Therefore, we see sometimes people prematurely going to Radha Kund and have this conception, not just for anybody in any path, this conception of ascent by practice. And they develop an egotism, a doership in that. Without the attitude of dependence and service. This is why service is so essential to sadhana. But sadhana is also service. We have to realize that. Service is essential to sadhana. Create the right conception of dependence in heart. Now, the last point that I'll discuss for today let me do something else. But last conception today is nice. He explains, and this boy, this is, you know, when it was, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, how the culture, a proper culture society would be, a proper cultural society would be imbued with that humility, detachment, the purity of heart. It would have, there'd be a culture that one could live in which facilitated developing the qualities that would allow the shy inner self to arise without conflict with the ego. She says, nevertheless, a certain cultural and spiritual atmosphere favors the secret and spontaneous development of the inner self. The ancient cultural traditions, both of the East and of the West, having a religious and sepential nature, favored the interior life. Indeed, transmitted certain common materials in the form of archetypal symbols, liturgical notes, art, poetry, philosophy, and myth, which nourish the inner self from childhood to maturity. In such a cultural setting, no one needs to be self-conscious about his interior life, and subjectivity does not run the risk of being deviated into morbidity and excess. You can have an inner life. This is the culture. The culture encouraged and supported a spiritual life, an eternal life. Unfortunately, such a cultural setting no longer exists in the West, or is no longer common property. It is something that has to be laboriously recovered by an educated, enlightened minority. Anyway, Prabhupada also talked extensively about the need for a supportive culture. And you can see his depth of understanding of Sambandhagyan understood that people did need supportive environments, and he tried his hardest to create farm communities and things that he thought could make that kind of supportive culture. Okay, anybody like to ask a question? I tried to share with you today something that I read. Would someone like to say hello?
I see someone else.
Gail? Thank you. I really needed someone to say hello just so that I knew that I wasn't talking to the wall.
I have a couple of questions. You know, when you were discussing, well, I guess I should ask the more pertinent one first. You know, it's not by our effort alone, obviously, that we become self-realized. You know, you're making a point that when Krishna sees our genuine need, you know, he grants the mercy then. So my question is, how I can come to the point where I'm actually experiencing that need?
Well, that is the practice. The practice is not to become disciplined or self-controlled. The practice is to excavate the heart and go deep and change the heart. That is the practice of Krishna consciousness. but it has to be accompanied, the practice has to be accompanied with a certain consciousness. Otherwise, it becomes mechanical. And what is mechanical? Like a car. You start the car, and then it goes on by its own without any conscious effort. So if the process of bhakti becomes like that, where you put on mechanical, there's no conscious effort, that's what Vaidhi Bhakti, in its strictest form, means. Vaidhi means you have faith in the rules. So because you have faith in the rules, then when you attend a spiritual program, like a Mangalarti, your faith is you'll get the benefit if you attend it. So your faith is the benefit comes from finishing the activity, not putting my consciousness into the activity. And that's what the part is, your consciousness into the activity. So it's very important to do that. And bhakti sanjayate bhakti, when we're conscious and we're turning and giving our consciousness to God, then there's some reciprocation in the heart. And the reciprocation in the heart. So there has to be something internal going on. And that has to develop a certain natural humility and a dependence. And that attracts God's mercy.
So when you're doing your sadhana with the conscious intention to cultivate, anyway, just performing sadhana with conscious intention, you will thereby experience genuine need.
Yeah, are you getting cut off here or something?
No, I'm wondering if you are hearing me.
I didn't.
Huh?
I didn't hear you.
You did not?
No.
Yeah. Oh, because I was responding. I was asking then, therefore, if I approach my sadhana with conscious intention, then I will come to the point of experiencing need.
Say that again. If I
perform my sadhana with the conscious intention of, developing my relationship
right.
with Krishna, then I will come to the point where I do experience the genuine need.
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's the process.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rare because this conception is that it's in God's hands. And he becomes attracted. He becomes allured by our need and dependence. And that comes from the practice, but the practice has to be done. I mean, just the fact that you can make a practice, there's consciousness. Then you turn on a car. There's some effort, but it's at the beginning. So even if you can't pay anything, there's some sincerity and effort, but there's more sincerity effort when one is concentrating and focusing on the mantras as they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what kind of mechanism are you listening to the class with?
The one I always listen to the class with.
It's
a regular phone. It's a landline.
It's a landline.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
do you have another question?
Yeah, I'll try to ask it, but our line is very choppy.
Do you have problems with your line there?
Not usually.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. Today we're having problems. Yeah, let me see if there's anyone else there. Anybody else like to say hello?
Okay.
Would you guys like to say hello today? Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, thank you. Bunchakalpa Taruga Shakra Basindi Baby Chakra.